Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for being here. Thank you for being prepared to sit on the stairs and wherever you were to get in here. What I want to say this morning is essentially a preview, really, for a book which will be coming out, I hope, in March of next year, which is going to be called, I think, Reenchanting Christianity. And as was just mentioned, I wrote a book called The Post-Evangelical, which was actually released here at Greenbelt in the summer of 1995. And though I've done a couple of other books in between time, I've always meant to do something which was a sort of follow-on, really, to The Post-Evangelical, and that's what this book is. If you think of The Post-Evangelical as a moment of disenchantment, of deconstruction, then this would be a moment of re-enchantment, and in that sense, on a more positive note. So what I want to do essentially is sort of read to you some parts of that, and then I'll stop and we can take some questions. But it serves really as a sort of introduction to that book. The ancient Hopi people of North America have got a fascinating rite of passage for their children as they move through into young adulthood. Throughout their life, these children have been familiar with the Kachinas, the tribe's masked holy men who bless the corn harvest and bring toys and gifts for the children, like Santa Claus, really. But one night, as the children are brought to the sacred circle where they normally receive their presents, something different occurs. On this occasion, instead of giving them gifts, the Kachinas simply remove their masks, revealing the fact that these figures, whom the children thought were God's magical figures, are actually their family and neighbours, people whom they see every day. Now, unfortunately, the church doesn't have anything quite like that Hopi ritual. There's no service of disenchantment for either young adolescents or adults, a kind of alpha in reverse, if you like, to help us to sort out what are the sort of childish things about Christianity that we should put behind us, and what are the things that we need to hold on to as we move forward. For us, the process is a lot more messy and often fraught, and yet it's an absolutely essential one. Indeed, paradoxically, experiencing disenchantment with the Christian faith is actually fundamental to growing as a Christian. It's the reality check that brings into question all that we've taken for granted. It's the acid bath that purges our naive assumptions, our false religious pretensions, our unthinking conformity. But what lies behind the disenchantment? What do we do when the mask is removed, when we realise that things can't be the way that they were or the way that we thought they were? That's what this book that I'm writing is really all about. One thing that we can say right from the start is that once the mask is removed, it can never be put back on again. The original innocence is gone and cannot be restored. But does that mean that we're damned to eternal cynicism, an everlasting cycle of doubt and suspicion? Or is there a second innocence, a means of re-enchantment? When the young Hopi sees for the first time the face behind the mask, he or she has to face a decision: to treat the whole world of religion as a charade, a sick joke, or to move forward to a more adult reality in the rituals and symbols of their people, a reality that points to a deeper mystery. In 1 Corinthians 13, St. Paul makes the point that there is a deeper mystery in Christianity which we cannot fully encounter even in this life. What we experience now, he says, is like a poor reflection in a mirror or an enigmatic riddle. To pursue this deeper mystery through the riddles and symbols of the Christian faith, knowing that these things are not the mystery itself, this is to follow the path towards a second innocence. Looking around, however, it's painfully clear that lots of people don't make it through to a second innocence. We're surrounded by people who used to believe, who used to go to church, but who no longer do. Often it's because they're locked into interpretations of Christianity that they can no longer own or accept. This is very sad because, in truth, the Christian tradition is so wonderfully rich and diverse. There are always other interpretations, other ways of looking at issues, other spiritual paths to explore, if only we can get to know them. The assumptions often made that those who struggle with doubts and questions, those who drift away from the church or even from mainstream Christianity, are in some way spiritually substandard, that they lack the grit or the piety to pursue the Christian faith. And yet the reality is often quite the reverse. Frequently, these are the people who are on a genuine spiritual journey, people who have outgrown religious certainties in their quest for a deeper reality of faith. And those who stay and look like they believe everything from A to B are often actually doing so merely out of conformity. When I was a child, Paul says, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put away childish ways. We're not meant to remain the same, to stick with the same outlook on life. We're meant to grow in many different kinds of ways. And as we grow personally and spiritually, it's inevitable that our faith will change as well, both in its content and in its form, and in the ways that we go about interpreting and applying it. And yet, whilst this can be exciting and stimulating, it can also be unnerving, as I'm sure many of you here today know, both to us and to people around us too, who think that we've lost our faith, that we're slipping away into darkness. For more than 20 years now, the phenomenon of the changing stages of faith have been recognised and studied in various ways. James Fowler, the most influential theorist in the field, has mapped out 7 distinct stages that tend to occur in people's faith development. As this happens, Fowler suggests that significant changes are likely to occur in these areas. 1, in the way that people think. 2, in their ability to see other people's points of view. 3, in the way that they arrive at moral judgments. 4, in the way and extent to which they draw boundaries around their faith community. We are the ones, and the rest are outside. 5, he says, the way that they relate to external authorities and their truth claims. 6, the way that they form their worldview. And then 7, the way that they understand and respond to religious symbols. Now, clearly, the content and form of a person's faith is going to change as they progress through those sort of changes as people, even perhaps to the point of seeming to disappear, their faith seeming to disappear altogether at times. And yet each stage of faith is in its own right fully Christian, even that which looks deeply agnostic. The psychotherapist Scott Peck offers a simplified version of Fowler's 7 stages of faith. He makes the fascinating observation that if people who were religious came to him as a therapist in pain and trouble, and if they became engaged in the therapeutic process, they frequently left therapy as atheists or skeptics. And frequently, the opposite would happen too. The people who came as skeptics and agnostics or even atheists would leave as deeply religious people. And this puzzled Peck. Same therapy, he says, same therapist. Successful but utterly different outcomes from a religious point of view. It didn't compute, he says, until he realized that we're not all in the same place spiritually. Setting aside a faith based on conformity and inherited assumptions, therefore, might well be part, and I would say very probably is part, of an authentic faith journey, a necessary experience of disenchantment. The big problem is that many churches are not too good at recognising the positive potential of disenchantment. You don't hear a lot of sermons about it. Indeed, the underlying assumption often appears to be that growing as a Christian means becoming even more fervent and resolute about what one already believes. The idea that one can be experiencing a period of deconstruction of one's faith and yet still be growing as a Christian, well, it hardly even enters the equation. And this begs the question as to what we think the church should be like. Is it supposed to be a gathering of like-minded believers who all share the same views on the Holy Trinity, salvation, the priesthood, sexuality, the infallibility of Scripture, or the interpretation of the 10-horned beast in Revelation? Or is it a place of openness and diversity where skeptics, doubters and dissenters are as much a part as devoted believers, traditionalists or even happy clappies? Got to be room somewhere. The fact is, the Christian message is surrounded by complex questions about the nature of the divine, about the Bible, about the person of Jesus, about the history of the church, about social ethics, and so on. Now, obviously, one doesn't need a PhD to explore the path of faith, but eventually, when a person wakes up and realizes that few things are as clear-cut as they were led to believe, the whole thing can come crashing down around their ears. Over the past decade or so, I've had frequent visits from students studying theology, many of whom have got backgrounds in conservative churches. Their stories all have a similar ring about them. Nothing had prepared them for the onslaught of their faith that they received in the first term at college or university. Like those Hopi who are suddenly exposed to what lies behind the masks, they realize that nothing can ever be quite the same again. One young man I talked with recently says that there's no way he can return to his home church, let alone pursue the ministry that he once thought that he would discover at college. He's decided to leave college with his degree later this year, but he's decided on a career in the media. Another young woman I know was told that her home group were praying against the spirit of liberalism in her college. And that was what used to be called London Bible College. That's true. The gap between critical approaches to Christianity and the simplistic spirituality promoted in many churches goes to the crux of so much disenchantment with Christianity today. Many long for an expression of the Christian faith that reconciles heart and head, that offers a positive, engaging spirituality, which is also committed to grappling honestly with difficult and painful questions. So is re-enchantment with Christianity possible in our postmodern, post-Christian age? Having embraced the doubts and questions and participated in the suspicion, having walked the critical path and seen behind the mask, can we find this second innocence? Well, I think that we can. However, we have to be clear about what we mean by expressions like re-enchantment and second innocence. Re-enchantment isn't a return to credulity. It's not an attempt to recapture some previous sense of enchantment with Christianity. Once the mask is removed, it cannot be replaced. Instead, we have to deal with the new reality opened up by the mask's removal. We must wager, and that's what it is. It's a wager that within and beyond the ambiguities of God talk, a greater reality waits to be explored. Following the publication of the Post-Evangelical, I received a colourful letter from a man who was clearly on a journey toward a second innocence. This is what he wrote. Did I say that right? A year ago, he says, I was in a state of rage, bordering on church burning. I felt like Winston, having escaped from Big Brother, or the savage in Brave New World, and wanted revenge for all those mind-fucking sermons. Miserable worm guilt feelings and the ludicrous newspeak that had been my life for 20 years. There was no church I could go into without having a severe reaction and either walking out or putting my fingers in my ears and going, la, 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 la. Which my wife found embarrassing. And looked like demonization to those who are so wise about these things. A copy of your book and a visit to Greenbelt were the first indications that I was not entirely alone. I'm now completely free from that stifling kind of religion that slowly strangles the life out of you and from the susceptibility to completely flee reality. My spirituality is now my own, not an undigested mixture interjected from 1,000 grim sermons and silly books. I can get in touch. Yes, I agree with that. It's terrible. She's read those books. He says, I can get in touch with the strength of it deep inside. I can read the words of Jesus, but their meaning has now changed, like rain into snowflakes. My mind is now open and not tight shut, and I feel an almost primitive sense of freedom and energy. With this man, it would sound like, achieved a second innocence, faith and spirituality that he could own for himself. Sadly, lots of people don't get there. They experience the deconstruction of faith, but they find no way through to its reconstruction. My church back in Holloway, St. Luke's, is one of those refuges which sadly are few and far between for those kind of people. A church that offers the hope of life beyond disenchantment and cynicism. A way to continue journeying positively and confidently with Christianity without needing to abandon our critical faculties. And I think I said in the post-evangelical that Greenbelt is in fact that sort of place. It's a church for a lot of people that they attend once a year. In the following parts of the book that I will be writing, I will unpack what I think a second innocence might look like in practice and say how I think it can be achieved. I'm confident that there is life beyond the mask of religious certainty. There's a way to hold intention, faith, and doubt. Madeleine L'Engle, the American writer, says, "If my religion is true, it will stand up to all my questioning. There is no need to fear. But if it is not true, if it is man's imposing strictures on God, as did the men of this Christian establishment of Galileo's day, then I want to be open to God, not to what men say about God. I want to be open to revelation, to new life, to new birth, to new light." Pat and I, my wife, we recently rediscovered a friend who we lost contact with many years ago. We first met Nick in the early 1970s when he was a zealous young convert, enthusiastic to tell the world about Jesus. He'd got long blonde hair in sort of Larry Norman style, if you know what I mean. And he had an infectious smile and a hippie shoulder bag that was bulging with tracts and leaflets and Jesus stickers. And he was living at the time in a fundamentalist Christian commune in London. For a while, that kind of Christianity seemed to suit Nick, as it does a lot of people. But after a couple of years, doubts and questions arose, some of which were directly linked to his struggle to reconcile Christianity with his homosexuality. When he found no way of squaring the two, he left the community with a faith that was gradually ebbing away. Over the years, we bumped into Nick here at Greenbelt, actually, but we never really talked about what was going on in his life. And then early last year, after a long spell of being out of touch, he contacted us and came around for dinner. Over the meal, we renewed our friendship and exchanged stories and talked about the way our faith had changed over the years. It became clear that Nick was looking to reconstruct his faith if he could, but he wasn't sure how. The next day, I received an email in which he wrote, "I shudder as I look back on my fundamentalist days, but here I am now, a 53-year-old gay man, wondering if I can recover some of the passion I once felt about Jesus. Our conversation has left me feeling that maybe I can." Nick's story is not uncommon. Many people who feel disaffected with the church and with Christianity still long to discover a faith that they can own for themselves, that they can inhabit with honesty and with integrity. During the 1990s, as lots of you will know, Pat and I led a group called Holy Joes, whose entire raison d'etre was to cater for people like Nick. For 10 years in a pub in South London, we listened over many pints of beer to unremitting stories of anger, hurt, disappointment and confusion, and mopped up plenty of tears into the bargain. Holy Joe's was for many a last resort, a final throw of the dice before walking away from the church, and possibly Christianity too. Most of those who came were in their 20s or early 30s. A few, like me, were just a little bit older. So, what? So, some were pushy and hard to shut up. Others were content to sit and listen. Some wanted heady discussion. Others needed somewhere to vent their spleen. What Holy Joe's offered was a no-holds-barred opportunity to discuss, debate, and argue about whatever it was about the church and Christianity that got their goat. No one passed judgment. There was no right answer imposed at the end of the evening. There were no right answers imposed. The people had to feel that they believed without necessarily understanding them or owning for themselves. For some, it really did prove to be a last stopping off point before leaving the church, for the time being at any rate. But for lots of others, it instilled the confidence to keep on journeying, even to find a way back into the church. I believe I'm one of five during the 10 years that I was at Holy Joe's who actually are now ordained, 4 in the Church of England and 1 almost in the Methodist Church. Perhaps the greatest virtue of Holy Joe's was the refusal to treat people as backsliders simply because they had doubts or because they were angry or hurt or because they found church boring or because they didn't want to worship or because they sometimes felt like throwing a hymn book at the preacher. Indeed, the assumption was that it would be very, very strange if we didn't feel these things at times. On the face of it, the church where I am now is a more conventional expression of church, but actually it offers a quite similar environment, an inclusive community where people of all stages of faith and none can embark with integrity on a voyage of discovery, searching perhaps for a second innocence. We have a monthly event called Headspace, which offers a very similar context to Holy Joe's, where there's an open forum for people to chew over the fat, listen to different opinions, disagree, argue, and hopefully find a way forward into the Christian faith that they can feel confident about, and which is congruent with their life and experience in the world of the 21st century. The person who alerted me to the notion of second innocence, and is the inspiration really for this book, was the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, who sadly died a couple of years ago. Ricoeur was renowned for his work in the field of hermeneutics, the theory of interpretation. He was a man of faith who grew up in a devout Protestant background in Catholic France. And whilst most of his work was not specifically religious, he made a major contribution to an understanding of how to interpret the text and symbols of Christianity in today's world. Ricoeur wrote a 550-page book on Freud and philosophy, apparently to understand why his gay son had committed suicide despite his family's love and acceptance of him. After going through all the ways that Freud tried to take apart religion and ritual, trying to reduce it to family patterns and illness, Ricoeur then takes apart Freud. Where Freud tries to show that religion is finally childish, Ricoeur uncovers the rebellious child's view of religion in Freud. He then makes way for a more adult view of religion through what he calls a second naivete, a second innocence. Basically, Ricoeur envisaged the process of interpreting the Christian faith as a kind of dialectical movement, really. Thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis. We begin with a naive acceptance of Christianity. We then experience a critical distance in which we deconstruct it. Finally, a new understanding of faith emerges that's deeper and more mature and which is informed and sharpened by the doubts and questions. So we discover a faith that is a synthesis of belief and doubt. That said, I should stress that the process isn't a straightforward linear route in which a second innocence is a kind of final destination. I've got there. I've got my second innocence. I can clearly remember people back in the mid-90s having read my book describing themselves as post-evangelical in a way that made me want to run away and throw up. Because of the superiority and the sense of a renewed kind of fundamentalism, if you like. Rather, the process is what Ricoeur calls a hermeneutical circle that must constantly be re-entered. Every new innocence will also require critical reflection in the light of new insights, new situations, new developments. Sadly, many people never get beyond the stage of critical distance, the deconstruction of their faith. Having been disenchanted, having seen the mask of religious certainty removed, they then presume that there's nowhere else to go in terms of faith development, so the journey draws to a close. Perhaps part of the difficulty is that the only apparent choice available to doubters and sceptics is to return to their original naivete or to abandon faith altogether. The first option's quite impossible, as I've said. Once the questions have been acknowledged, the doubts expressed, the critical process embraced, there's no going back. Something of the immediacy of belief, the sense of certainty, has been lost and cannot be recovered. So the only route open appears to be that of leaving faith behind as part of a childish outlook on life. And yet Ricoeur's approach makes it clear that re-enchantment is indeed possible, a hope expressed in the marvellous exclamation that he gives in one of his books where he says, "Beyond the desert of criticism, we wish to be called again. How then does this second innocence come about? How do we reconnect with the Christian faith once we've entertained the doubts and questions? How can we be called again, as he puts it? Well, he says it's by interpreting that we can be called again. We can believe, he says, only by interpreting. We can rediscover a living faith and spirituality only by entering into the matrix of reinterpretation, by grappling with the paradoxes of an ancient tradition, engaging imaginatively with contemporary perception and insight. In some parts of the church, that exercise appears futile. Interpretation is thought unnecessary. The truth is clear and straightforward, and you just have to believe it on face value. But for a lot of us, that just won't wash. To begin with, we're children of a scientific age. We cannot take at face value, therefore, an ancient text that tells us that the world was created in 6 days, when we know that it evolved over billions of years. But more than that, the scientific outlook has led us, as a matter of course, to doubt and question what we're told in all other areas of life. Whether the source of information is a college professor, a news broadcast, an article on the internet, or the Bible. Naturally, this leaves Christians with all kinds of problems. Can we still accept the premise that the Bible is true? And if so, in what way is it true? What do we do, for example, with the creation accounts in Genesis, or with stories like Noah and the Ark, the crossing of the Red Sea, or Jonah being swallowed by a big fish? More importantly, what do we make of the doctrine of the incarnation, the virgin birth, the miracle accounts of the Gospels, or the resurrection of Christ? You may or may not be pleased to know that I'm not going to try to answer all those questions here today. They are very important questions, and they mustn't be dodged. And yet, fundamentally, I don't believe that there's any intrinsic conflict between science and faith, provided we're willing to place our faith into the matrix of reinterpretation. So the question's not, do I believe the Bible, but rather, how do I interpret it in today's world? What do I make of 2,000 years of Christian tradition? How do I make sense of the creedal faith of the early church that was formulated in an entirely different cultural environment to my own? How can I glean the wisdom of ancient ideas in a scientific age? What can I make of patriarchal practices in a post-feminist society? What do the antiquated texts, symbols, and rituals of Christianity offer to my world and to my culture? But we're also members of a pluralist society that recognizes the value of cultural and religious diversity, living as we do in a community where difference is not only taken for granted but celebrated, requires that we re-examine and reinterpret aspects of our faith. And so another bunch of questions begin to surface. How does God look upon people of other faiths? Is God bigger than Christianity? Are we supposed to get people to change their religion and join us? Or can we accept that they are following God along a different route? Is there still a role for Christian mission in a pluralist world? And if so, what should it be? These are tough questions, but they require answers, albeit provisional ones, perhaps, along the way. Technology has now shrunk the world, creating a new level of globalism, so that we're far more aware, for example, of worldwide injustice. And this too challenges the nature of our Christian faith and commitment. In the past, missionaries were sent to lands of darkness to convert the heathen to Christianity. But now we recognize the darkness in our own land and in the Western world in general, where a massive culture of economic progress is built on a legacy of trade injustice. Many people leave the church or become disillusioned with Christianity because they see little sign that seeking justice is a priority to the church. Charities and campaigning groups that actively pursue a more just and equitable world are absolutely littered with people who used to go to church, who used to believe, or who pursue some form of churchless spirituality. These people's faith can only be re-enchanted through a reinterpretation of the priorities of Christian faith and mission. Science, pluralism, and globalism are just three areas where huge challenges confront Christianity today. The need is to make new imaginative connections between Christianity and the wider world. As Nicholas Lash, the Oxford professor, argues, the confusion and uncertainty which many Christians experience today is perhaps less obviously the expression of a crisis of faith than a crisis of culture. We are not sure, he says, how to go about the business of connecting our Christianity with other aspects of our life and experience. And that, of course, is precisely why our friend Nick, his disenchantment with Christianity came about. Much as he wanted to believe, he just couldn't make the connection between his faith and his experience. The key for him is the realization that there are other interpretations, other applications of Christianity to those he originally received. Without making the vital connections between Christianity and the contemporary world, between an inherited faith and personal experience, that faith will inevitably wither and die. Or it remains ghettoized and irrelevant, a preoccupation of diehard fundamentalists. The point is made uncompromisingly in the title of one of Bishop Jack Spong's books, Christianity Must Change or Die. The way that he wants to see a change and the way he describes it is not precisely the way that I would, but I believe very much in the principle that he is enunciating there. I'll just go a little further and then we'll pause for some questions. I think that one of the things that we talk about in Christianity is that Christianity is a historic religion, and that's often a defence of keeping it exactly as it is. And of course it appears indisputable that Christianity is a historic religion, but what does that mean? Well, the theologian Maurice Wiles argues that the term historical religion can in fact be interpreted in two ways. On the one hand, it might mean, he says, that Christian tradition is fixed, that we can't mess with it, that we're bound by the character or language or content of its origins. In other words, we're tied to the past. Or alternatively, historical, he says, may mean that Christianity is part of the changing patterns of history, that it is prepared to adapt itself to changing circumstances, and that making those changes actually ensures its continuity and vitality. But I want to ask Maurice Wiles, are we faced with an absolute choice between the two? These two ways of interpreting the historical nature of Christianity. Personally, I wish to maintain that Christianity is an historical religion to some extent in both senses of the phrase, that the Christian faith is indeed radically dependent on the past and on particular historical events, but that it's also a living, evolving faith that must adapt to new situations, new circumstances, new insights. Robert Runcie once put it very well, I think, when he said, "A church which listens only to its tradition will end up speaking only to itself. A church which listens only to what is happening in the world will end up becoming only a dull echo of the latest liberal fashion. It is the interplay between tradition and discovery that creates a proper relevance." My own way of describing this third way of thinking about Christianity is to label it progressive orthodoxy. A faith that's fed and nurtured by a rootedness in past events, that's the orthodox bit, but which is also shaped and energized by a dynamic interaction with the world of the present, the progressive end. Some people who support my point of view will, I'm sure, wince at my use of the word orthodoxy, which smacks of rigidity and inflexibility. But I don't think it necessarily has to be the case, and I'm personally disinclined to hand that term over to those who are indeed rigid and inflexible about Christianity. In an essay written some years ago by Rowan Williams, he identified two distinctly different approaches to the term orthodoxy. The first is a closed system. It's pre-packed, predetermined, watertight, a comprehensive ideology. This sort of orthodoxy stifles thought and distorts perception. It allows for no real conversation. It's a monologue. No critical element is admitted. There's no conversation in that kind of orthodoxy because actually everything has already been said, and all that's left to do is repeat it again and again and again ad nauseam. There can be nothing new to say that isn't just a reiteration in different ways of what has already been said. The second approach to orthodoxy is basically what I'm calling progressive orthodoxy. Here, orthodoxy is seen not as a pre-packed truth handed down from the past, but as a tradition of shared speech, of shared symbols, a living community of revelation and dialogue, a tradition that invites a process of critical questioning, This approach to orthodoxy doesn't claim to possess the truth, simply to have perspectives on it. Tradition is not static or fixed, but is dynamic and evolving. Progressive orthodoxy centers on a dialogue between the traditions of the past and the insights and struggles of the contemporary setting. It affirms that there are always new things to see, new things to understand, that divine revelation is a constant process, not a once and for all event in the past. In its own kind of pink and fluffy way, the film My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which I'm sure you've all seen, is all about the tension between tradition and progress. Tula, the central figure, is trying to break free from the restrictions of her patriarchal Greek background without snubbing her father and his obvious love for her. As she tussles with her mixed feelings, her brother Nick drops a pearl of wisdom right in the middle of this film, which made me go pring. He says, "Tula, don't let your past dictate who you are, but let it be part of who you will become." That's pretty good. That should be in the Bible. I'll speak to the author. Don't let your past dictate who you are, but let it be part of who you will become. I wonder if that could be a working definition of what I'm calling progressive orthodoxy, of a faith that's deeply rooted in the originating sources of Christianity, but which recognizes that the Holy Spirit continues to reveal new insights from the present situation. Don't let your past dictate who you are, but let it be part of who you will become. Let me just read you one quote, which I'll finish with for the moment, and that is where Kenneth Burke's got a sort of graphic portrayal of the drama of history, which I think could equally be a description of Christian tradition, as I understand it in a positive sense, as an unending conversation to which we have the opportunity to contribute. This is what he writes. Where does the drama of history get its material? From the unending conversation that is going on at the point of history when we were born. Imagine that you enter a parlor. You come late. When you arrive, others have long preceded you, and they are engaged in a heated discussion. A discussion too heated for them to pause and tell you exactly what it's all about. In fact, the discussion had already begun long before any of them got there, so that no one present is qualified to retrace for you all the steps that had gone before. You listen for a while, then you put in your oar. Someone answers, you answer him. Another comes to your defence. Another aligns himself against you to either the embarrassment or gratification of your opponent, depending upon the quality of your ally's assistance. However, the discussion is interminable. The hour grows late. You must depart. And you do depart with the discussion still vigorously in progress. What a lovely description, not just of history, but of what I understand Christian tradition is all about. Not this monolithic thing that's come to us from the past, not a parcel that we pass on, keeping it exactly intact, but as a dynamic, vigorous conversation, an argument even. And isn't that what church history has always been? It's always been an argument. We think of the creeds as something that just sort of emerged somewhere in church history, passed down from heaven. They came out of centuries of vigorous arguing and disagreeing. And this, I believe, is how the church and Christian tradition must continue in that state of vigorous argument and discussion. So let me pause there and see if you have any questions that you'd like to ask.
Hi, yeah, thanks for that. That was really good. One question I've got is, to what extent does a new innocence, if at all, relate to what you could call a new excitement? How does that relate to what you're saying?
Well, I think that if we're not excited, then, you know, it won't be a second innocence. It won't be a next innocence. I think that excitement is going to be part of it. But I think that it's not necessarily the excitement of, you know, kind of emotional highs, but I think the excitement of being on a journey, which we don't actually know entirely what lies just around the corner. And so, and perhaps you know, I mean, another sort of a next part of the book really that would emerge really would be to concentrate on the issue of spirituality, because I think that when I say, following Paul Ricoeur, that a new innocence emerges out of reinterpretation, I think that suggests that it's all a kind of cerebral process, and I don't think that's true. I don't think that will sustain us. I think that if we're to continue on a journey with Christianity, there must also be a new kind of a renewed spirituality within. And I think that that perhaps means, for many, drawing on traditions of the church, spiritual tradition of the church, that we haven't known in the past. It may mean all sorts of things, but I think that essentially what will sustain us on in the journey is energy. We need energy, and I think some of that energy needs to be mental energy, you know, that we get excited about new thoughts, new possibilities, new frameworks, new interpretations of aspects of Christianity, but also a new energy spiritually that probably is going to be sort of moving us on from the energy sources that we've had, in spiritual energy sources we've had in the past, which have now run dry and no longer sustain us. And, you know, I think it's really important that, you know, the whole idea of a new innocence doesn't mean that we look back on what was before and just rubbish it all, because it's part of us. It's part of our history. And I look back on times of waving my hands in the air and singing choruses and, you know, which was part of my life for years. And I can look back on some stages of my life now and feel embarrassed about it. And I've often said, you know, to my wife, you know, if, yeah, I just feel I've been sort of duped here, you know, and feel mad with myself and stupid with myself for having allowed myself to go there. And why couldn't I be where I am now 20 years ago, you know? But she's, of course, much wiser and much calmer than me. And, you know, just points out the obvious truth that you're only where you are now because of where you've come. And so let's not rubbish the past. And if I give that impression, then that's not what I'm wanting to do. But rather to acknowledge the fact that, you know, the journey will take us into new pastures, down new avenues. And, you know, the road leads back there. That was part of this road. But we're not at that stage of the road and the journey now.
I'm an evangelical Christian, born again, and I received Jesus when I was 19, and that didn't worry me about being homosexual, but it did when I started going to church and started hearing a preacher preaching about homosexuality is wrong, and I think, oh, I'm a Christian, how can I change? I can't change. I did try to change my sexuality, but I am still as gay as ever. I'm gay as a coot.
Can we do the Crocodile Dundee trick and get people to pass the thing across?
Do we need to get re-enchanted with Christianity, or do we just need to get re-enchanted with God?
Oh, yeah, well, that's a good question. I think that, you know, that could be a matter of semantics, but it may not be. And I think that when I posed the question earlier in the context of pluralism, is God bigger than Christianity? Well, I hope you'd know my answer would definitely be yes. I think Christianity is clearly a man-made structure, you know, in terms of history and theology and so on, of an experience with God. And so as such, I think it obviously has to be under constant kind of, you know, revision and questioning. I think that I don't really have any kind of truck with, you know, needing to defend Christianity. That's, you know, I do believe that God is bigger than Christianity. Christianity is a way of describing the tradition in which I have found God. And I'm quite happy and comfortable with that, and I'm happy to sort of stand up and say I'm a Christian. So it's, you know, but of course, I don't think that Christianity is the be-all and end-all in terms of how God speaks or is revealed in our world today. So, Yeah, and I think certainly in a world that's charged with sort of religious hatred and religious conflict, then, you know, I would certainly not want to stand up behind those people who are sort of wanting to fight for Christianity over against Islam or Buddhism or whatever else. I just don't want to play that game at all. I recognise in people who are in other faiths and people who have no faith at all, I recognise brothers and sisters who are on, you know, kindred spirits and on a similar journey. And, you know, I've got friends and had friends over the years who, out of their own intellectual and I suppose spiritual honesty and integrity, would say that they are atheists, but who I recognise as fellow travellers. You know, it is, you're right about God, absolutely. But the point is, because we know God through a particular tradition, you know, that's how most of us do, then I think it is through the renewing of that tradition or the reinterpreting of it that it's possible that our vision of God will enlarge and expand.
I mean, it's related to the question of God, it's related to two things you just said. On a personal level, you look back and you say, you know, what you did 20 years ago is quite embarrassing. Again, on this personal level, you talk about the dialogue you have with other people. I'm wondering, as a church, if we have a model that looks on faith as a journey or as stages, how as a church can we practically avoid that sense of superiority and looking down on others who are on a different journey or a different stage without feeling somehow we've got it, we're higher or better than them?
Yes.
Very much on a practical level as a church.
I think it's very difficult because I think that, you know, we're grappling with human nature, and that's why I think actually the question that the previous person asked is a good one, an important one, that I think that if we put all our kind of eggs, if we put all our identity within this thing, Christianity, then it is likely that we will see that over against others and therefore make the sort of judgments you're talking about. But if we can hold Christianity, you know, as the tradition within which our faith is expressed, lightly and without feeling that this is the only way in which God is revealed in our world, then I think it is possible to hold on to a kind of humility that is more than willing to you know. I don't know if any of you were at the service that we led the other night from my church in the New Forms Cafe, but we had a number of slide presentations that was juxtaposing things that Christians and Christian leaders have said over against pictures that were, you know, for instance, things that they've said over the years about women, horrible crap things, over against pictures of women today who clearly you recognise this is rubbish. And there was one about the other faiths too, and there was a quote of one Christian leader who said, unless you're a born again Christian, you are a failed human being, which went straight from that sort of statement on the screen into a picture of the Dalai Lama with this glorious big grin on his face going which I feel is more powerful than any sermon I could ever preach.
I guess a question almost opposite to that, so a church potentially feeling maybe superior, a difficult question really, but what if somebody is perhaps reached or getting close to that stage of a second innocence and they're really excited, they've got that new energy that you've been talking about, but they can't find a church, you know, they go back to the church and it's still the old stuff.
Mm.
So what do you do? Are you
stuck
on your own?
Oh dear, that's a question I can't answer. It's you know, it's really, really hard, isn't it? And obviously I have people all the time asking me that. I think that, you know, the nice sort of theoretical answer would be to say, you go and be part of the renewal of it. And in a way I believe that. But I also am realistic to know that can be really, really hard. And you know, I think that the fact is, I mean, with our own church, which I'm very committed actually to the idea of being a parish community, and you know, that's a new part of my journey as a sort of member of the church. I didn't grow up in the Anglican tradition, and I'm very committed to building up the parish community. But I'm also realist enough to recognise that a lot of people are going to want to come from all over the world, and we do have people coming from the outer reaches of London regularly to St. Luke's. And But as you go out across the country and look at it, it's really, really hard. And I think that the important thing is to find ways of nurturing your own spirituality. That's really what matters. In the end, at the end of the day, you know, if we can be part of a church community that see things in enough of a similar way that it does revitalize and energize, that's wonderful. But it is a luxury. And I think that, you know, it's not the be-all and end-all of everything. There are ways to sustain yourself, I think, which means finding your, you know, finding ways to connect to the bigger community, you know, of people who are on that journey with you, through reading books, through kind of going to places like Greenbelt, through sort of the internet, through, you know, all sorts of other sort of ways and means, but trying to find ways constantly. I have felt in that position myself in the past. You know, I was a square peg in a round hole, and I did have people who were kind of, on the one hand, you know, following my leadership, but on the other hand, who questioned everything that I said and everything I was about. And there were times when it felt very lonely. But I found the people, the sources out there that became, you know, sources of life to me. And I think it's tough, but that's how it is, really.
We'll have to make this the last question.
Thank you. Much of your talk this morning has been about personal transformation and about personal journeys of faith. But interestingly, many of the questions have been about communities and the way communities and church communities grapple with these issues. I wondered if you think that the popularity of phrases like emerging church and alternative worship forms show that in some ways Second Innocence is also a community phenomenon, and that perhaps these are manifestations of churches themselves as units going through transformation into Second Innocence.
I'm sure they are. I think that what I would be what I'd be uneasy about is if we sort of equate that, you know, say emerging church, alt worship, what have you, is the Second Innocence way, using my terminology, because it's not as clear cut as that. And I think that, just as I said, that, you know, over the years I've come across lots of people using the term post-evangelical that leave me feeling deeply uneasy. I do find that with emerging church too. I think that the term can become a new elitism. And that's deceptive in itself, because what we're looking for isn't a new kind of church. That's nice, but that's not it. We're not looking for some new structure. We're not looking, in my book, for some nice new ways to interpret it, and then that's it. You know, as soon as we sort of put our kind of tent pegs down and say, this is where we are, we've arrived, you know, we've fallen into the trap, the old trap, you know. So I think that, yeah, it's great. I think, you know, fresh expressions, emerging church, all these things, they are expressions of the fact of a hunger within people's souls and within their spiritual lives, looking for something more. And it's great that they're emerging there and that they are coming onto the scene. But, you know, let's not make the sort of that judgment that that's it. Because actually, you may find yourself going into what looks like an incredibly traditional church and find that that is just vibrantly alive spiritually, you know, and it's not cool and it's not trendy, it's not any of those things. But actually, you know, the spirit is there, because it is to do with an attitude of heart and not to do with a new form of worship or belief or whatever else it may be. So, you know, that I can't emphasize that strongly enough, really.